All right, this is lesson 5 of Medicine and Morals. The class is titled With You in Mind, but let's first get to some review questions. Review question number 1, what are some of the halakhically questionable issues with artificial insemination donor? We cited 3 issues of possibly more. What were some of the issues? Adultery, good.
Marrying your sibling.
Marrying your sibling, good, because we don't know the identity of the dad, possibly. Probably. What was the other one?
Who's the daddy?
Who did daddy? Who did baby daddy?
Integration of the institution of marriage.
There you go. Tearing down the institution of marriage, which in itself is a mitzvah. Okay, good. Those were 3 of the issues that we discussed at some length. Okay, second question. Why might artificial insemination husband be problematic, and how might this concern be addressed? So what is the problem with artificial insemination husband? It seems to satisfy these 3 issues.
Mix up in the lab?
That's right. We got some mixing of the genes. And we're not talking about the Levi's with the polos. This we're talking about, yeah?
It's going to be a good class.
Yeah, this is going to be good. We're talking about the mixing of the genetic gametes. And how might this concern be addressed? Huh?
Have a maskech and don't screw up.
Exactly, right. Got to have somebody there and keep it kosher. Now, by the way, I spoke to somebody after the class, after both classes last week, and I found out that in some fertility clinics, labs, whatever, the way they do it is they actually put tags on all the genetic material, and the layover, I don't know if that's the right term, but the gap in time between getting the sperm from the husband and actually doing the insemination is about 2 to 3 hours. So in a very controlled environment where there's a very quick turnaround time and you got somebody there watching, it would remove the problem. By the way, what they do with the genetic material is they actually run it through a process where they purify it before they actually inseminate it. So you have to make sure that they're not mixing in anything that's biological substance. Anyway,
you're just talking about insemination.
No? Correct. In vitro would be also a similar issue. Yeah, could be very, very possible.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So artificial insemination would be a quicker process, 2-3 hours. You're right. I didn't find that out in vitro. I would imagine it takes maybe a few days or longer. Yeah. Okay. And number 3 is, what is the Jewish position?
In vitro, they can screw up and mix up the eggs too.
Correct. They can get the whole thing wrong.
But you know, they only do that once, most of them.
Correct. once they do that, they may have to find another use of that building. Okay, what is the Jewish position on embryonic stem cell research?
Kosher.
Are we kosher or not kosher on that?
Kosher.
We took a quote, liberal stance by saying that the pre-embryos are not considered to be life. Okay, all right, let's transition into this week's topic. This week we look at mental illness in Jewish law. So the questions that we'll address, the questions are, what does halacha say, what does Jewish law say about the care of those who cannot be in control of their own affairs? So really what we're trying to figure out is, how does Judaism try to strike a balance between taking control or helping protect someone who is mentally ill from harm, at the same time protect their independence and their dignity? That's the balance we're going to figure out how we're going to be dealing with. And what guidance does Torah have for us for acting ethically and compassionately with one who is suffering with mental illness? So what are the guidelines that Torah gives us? So it's a very important topic. It's a very sensitive topic, and it's what we're going to deal with tonight. So I'll first begin with this. Mental illness is real, and it's prevalent. It's more prevalent, perhaps, than we think. A study came out last week You have one in front of you underneath the review questions. Literally was published on the 18th of November, last Thursday. Nearly one in five Americans had mental illness in 2009. Yep.
In one year,
what's the total here? They had 45 million Americans. Again, some form of mental illness. We're not talking about full-blown psychosis. We're talking about some form of mental illness, whatever it is. Okay, so obviously there's a broad range. I'm not sure. But if you look at the study in the second paragraph, young adults aged 18 to 25 had the highest level of mental illness at 30%. I mean, that's a staggering figure. It's a staggering figure. Some, whatever it is, any form of mental illness, 30% of young people, 18 to 25? It's a staggering number. Interestingly enough, over 50, huh? Right. Whatever the definition, the bottom line is that I would venture to say that most of us in this room, if not all of us, have some sort of connection or relation with somebody that we know or that we love that struggled with some form of mental illness. Yet despite, I will say, tragically, despite all of the advances that we've made in medicine, it's one of the most unknown parts of the human machine, which is the brain. It's one of the most unknown. It's like we've gone so far in medicine, yet the brain remains this mystery. And there are too few desirable treatments for those suffering with mental illness. Now, so when we talk about describing or categorizing mental illness, so there's some disorders are pervasive. They just completely take over the person. Some only affect specific aspects of a person's behavior. Some are chronic and constant. Some mental disorders are not only pervasive but constant. Some flare up from time to time. Some are triggered by a certain mechanism or a certain situation that triggers the mental illness. And of course, the effect of mental illness also can vary from those who are able to manage very well and function well in society to those who cannot at all function. But whatever form it takes, I want to tell you that Judaism, Jewish Lahalacha, takes mental illness extremely seriously and considers it absolutely the same as any physical or physiological ailment. It's the same thing. So a psychiatrist is as much of a medical of a physician as any other physician. In other words, it's not like mental illness is considered a separate category of ailment. It's the same. It's in the same ballpark, and therefore it becomes just like as we explained in the first lesson. One has to go to a doctor. One has to take care of their physical health. One has to take care of their mental health as well. It becomes obligatory to address mental disorders and mental illness. Another parallel that we find in Jewish law is just as we suspend other mitzvot to preserve our physical life. You know, we have many examples before. If somebody is, God forbid, trapped under rubble, or somebody is drowning, or a woman is about to give birth, as in my personal experience, my wife. So you suspend all laws in the Torah, except for the big three. You suspend all laws, including Shabbos, kosher, whatever it is, to save, preserve physical life. The same would be for one's psychological life, psychiatric life. Laws, mitzvot, are suspended to preserve mental health. If we're dealing with a threatening situation, obviously, of mental health. Moreover, I'm adding another layer to this. So we had, first of all, Judaism considers it on an equal level. You're obligated to seek out help if one is obligated to seek out help if one needs that help. Other mitzvot are suspended for the preservation of one's mental health. And moreover, any halachic decision that is going to be made will take one's mental health into consideration. which comes into play regarding the very, perhaps you might call it, hot button issue of abortion. Your Jewish law takes a pretty tough stance regarding abortion and says that life does not definitively begin only at birth, but rather there's life before birth. And therefore, abortion is not the general rule is abortion is not okay unless the mother's life is endangered. And this extends also to the mother's mental health. In other words, if there's a situation where the mother would be, and again, every case would have to be judged on its own merit, in its own circumstances, you know, the way it is. There's no general fast rule. But I just want to point out that not only do we suspend other rules for mental health, this would be pretty much a similar concept. You would, when making any halakhic determination, the question about abortion, is it okay in this case or not? You would take into consideration the mother's, the individual's state of mind. So Jewish law understands the reality of mental disorder and illness and extends great sensitivity. Halachically, this is something we're not going to get into tonight. Halachically, there are various categories of mental illness and disorder. Many, many categories. That's not what we want to focus on tonight. We're not going to focus on how halachically do we determine the level of the category of mental illness. We're not going to get into that. What we're going to look at are two issues pertaining to the ethical treatment of those suffering with mental illness. The ethical treatment of those suffering with mental illness. Number one, safeguarding. The first issue we're going to be talking about is safeguarding the welfare of those suffering with mental disorders by appointing a guardian. And what are the ethical responsibilities and considerations involved? Somebody is not able to, talked about this in the opening, someone is not able to handle their own affairs. So there needs to be, in halakhic terminology, called an apotrophos, which means a guardian. Somebody that is on top of their affairs. Question is, what is the degree of responsibility and freedom that person has, the guardian. Okay, the second issue we're going to talk about is inclusion of the mentally ill within the general and specifically the Jewish community. And what that does for, what benefit and therapeutic, what therapeutic benefit can be gained from such inclusion. So we'll be talking about these two ethical issues. Okay, so let's begin. We're up to section 2, which is stewardship, page 156 in the book. So in the Amidah, if you take a look at the Amidah every single day, the daily Amidah is recited 3 times. It opens with 3 blessings that are general blessings, and then it transitions into personal blessings. The very first request that we recite every day, 3 times a day, is the request for sound mental health. Ben, please read this. Text number 1.
You graciously bestow knowledge upon humans and teach mortals understanding. Graciously bestow upon us from your wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Blessed are you, God, who graciously bestows knowledge.
So again, think about it. The first thing we ask is that God grant us wisdom, understanding, knowledge, a sound mind to be able to make decisions, to understand things, to know things. It's a powerful concept. And certainly it's very difficult, it's very painful when one is afflicted with mental illness or a mental disorder. It becomes tremendously painful, especially if that person was of sound mind prior. If somebody was previously of sound mind, then the pain can be compounded by the fact that the person who is now suffering with that mental illness or whatever it is may feel a more acute sense of pain of recognizing that they are going through a breakdown and not being able to get themselves out of it. So it's doubly painful. And perhaps as painful, I don't know if you could really say as painful, but perhaps another element of this pain and difficulty surrounding mental illness is vis-a-vis how others interact with that person. You know, I don't think I need to speak at great length about the fact that many, oftentimes, individuals distance themselves from those who are going through, struggling with mental health. There's silence, they're avoided, they're shunned, perhaps even to extent of abused. Individuals are abused and taken advantage of because of their mental state.
Good question.
It's like too cute for the situation. Anyway, yeah.
Something I've wondered about a couple of years in that, the way this is written.
Yeah.
It uses, for instance, Atachonek la Adam.
Yeah.
Adam for humans. But then it goes on and uses the word Enush. Why is there the difference there? Because Enush, the translation is mortals. Is it a different aspect of humanness? Can you explain that? I've always wondered about that one.
There's different terms that mean man or human. There's Adam, Ish, and Enosh. And they have different connotations.
What's the difference?
If I'm not mistaken, each one brings out a different element of the human being. Adam brings out the concept of the superiority of man. It's like the higher part of man. Adam el elyon, domes, similar to above. Whereas Enosh brings out more of the human. When I say human, I mean the mortal aspect. And Ish, I don't know, I think one refers to intelligence, one refers to speech, and one refers to something else. Now, there's different ways of understanding. I gotta look it up again. But it's subtle. There's subtleties there. But anyway, let's get back to this idea. So, bottom line is, we ask for a blessing for mental health. We recognize the pain involved when one is struggling with mental health. We recognize that the pain can be compounded by how others are reacting to and treating those who are struggling with mental health. And it's a serious issue. It's a serious issue, even to the extent of, forget about somebody straight out abusing or ripping off and otherwise taking advantage of someone who's struggling with their health, with their mental health. Think about the concept of how attitudes of people that are not struggling with mental health and how they view those who are. So I'll tell you, there are studies that were done recently, very recently, talking 2007. Here are some results of these studies. 40% of people believe that major depression is just a lack of willpower. This is what 40% of the U.S. population believes. That someone that is suffering with major depression, it's just because they don't have enough willpower. Dismissive, like that. 50% believe it's a result of expecting too much from life. Again, dismissive. Oh, you just have unrealistic expectations, that's why you're so depressed. Give up your expectations, you'll be fine. 60% say that effective treatment is just to, quote, pull yourself together, end quote. So reflected in these numbers, reflected in these surveys, is a real lack of consideration and understanding of what mental illness is really about. Major depression is not just about, you know, getting stronger and pulling yourself together. It's an illness. Torah, Judaism recognizes that as such. And for it to be dismissed like that, again, reflects a complete lack of caring, understanding, and consideration of that individual's human dignity. So, it's appropriate to read a quote from King Solomon. King Solomon bemoans the exploitation of the mentally ill in text 2 as he protests to God. Lynn, will you please read text 2?
God, everything you have made in your universe is beautiful, and wisdom the most beautiful of all, except for madness. What benefit can there be in a person being mad? A mad person walks in the marketplace and tears his clothes while children mock him and chase him and people jeer at him. Is this beautiful before you?
So King Solomon is really, if you had to categorize his statement, what is he doing? What is his statement? It's a protest.
This whole quote is not from the Maggid,
is it? No, it's from the Medrash. The Midrash.
Written on some story in Shmuel Hall.
Yep. Yes. So, no. It's before his time. He's brought in. I don't know the context. But it's brought in. But Solomon says, what's the most beautiful... He turns to God. He says, what's the most beautiful thing in the world? We know Solomon was all about wisdom. He says, wisdom. And everything is beautiful except for madness. What purpose is there? It's really the age-old question is, why do people suffer? He's really asking another form of, why do people or good people, why does anybody, forget good or bad, let's not make judgments about character, why should anybody suffer? Why do people suffer with mental illness? What's the point? What beauty or what benefit could there possibly be in your world, God, for this to be?
I heard an explanation from Rabbi Schuster once.
An explanation?
He was talking about how everybody has a purpose in this.
Okay.
The voice from the back piped up and said, yeah. Well, what about those who are physically or mentally challenged?
Yeah.
And he said, when you see somebody like that and you say, thank God that, you know, my children are good and healthy and vibrant, and you direct your attention to a higher power, that's their job. And it's a beautiful thing.
Okay.
And their soul is even on a higher plane.
That's
so it's not tainted. No,
that's true. But
it was a beautiful explanation.
I hear you. Okay, all right. Let's...
But you can move on.
No. I hear. Mm-hmm. I want to be careful here because to use somebody and say that thank God I'm not like them or thank God my kids are not like them, that even in its blessing is still, in a sense, putting down.
Well,
and I understand that might be okay.
I understand,
and I think that it goes up to a certain point. But I don't know if it. Anyway, but King Solomon says, "No." King Solomon expresses a frustration and a lack of understanding of what the purpose could possibly be. What could it possibly be? And indeed, I will tell you that the. In my opinion, the response should be one of protest. And one of davening to Hashem that this illness, like all other illnesses, should be removed. That there's no place for suffering, for any suffering, whether it's a physical illness or psychological illness. But the second point that he makes is the one... So, in other words, what God can control and what He doesn't for whatever reason and what we demand that He change... ASAP, through our davening, our tefillot, etc. So what's in His court, that's in His court. But we can control what's in our court. Here's the power of the statement of King Solomon. Because he has a second point in his statement. He says, a mad person walks in the marketplace, tears his clothes, while children mock him and chase him, and people jeer at him. Is this beautiful before you? So again, the question before God is the question that remains. And we need to still be stuck in that question. But the question that pertains to the human being, that pertains to society, how is it that it's okay that we either verbally, physically abuse, and even if it's not physical or verbal, even if it's in our own mind, that we're making judgments about the person and saying, well, you should really get yourself together. I don't know. Put it together. 60% say effective treatment for those in major depression is, quote, just pull yourself together, end quote.
That's right.
So what I'm saying is, that's the issue that we do need to deal with. That's the issue that we as human beings can and must deal with. The issue of why God allows it in His world, That's a bigger question than we could answer. And we need to ask the question. We don't need to answer the question. We need to ask the question. But the question of why is it that we as a society or people in society are not sensitive, do not grant dignity to those that are suffering with mental illness. That's a question that we need to answer. That's something, and the answer is change. The answer is, well, how do we actually respond? How do we deal with those who are suffering with severe mental illness and disorder? So, there are teachings from Torah that we can apply to this. That, and again, Torah means instruction. Torah means lesson or instruction. So Torah is always our guide when dealing with situations that need guidance. So what does Torah tell us about how one is to deal with, relate to somebody suffering from a mental disorder? We go to text 3a. Fred, please read text 3a and then text 3b.
You shall not curse a deaf person. You shall not place a stumbling block before a blind person. And you shall fear your God. I am the Lord.
Okay, what is Torah saying? Huh?
Lifnei Aver.
Yeah. But what's the idea of not cursing a deaf person?
He can't hear you do it.
Right. So what's wrong?
God hears.
So the only detriment God hears. Would be not to the deaf person, it's the person who's doing the cursing.
Ah. Think about it. Torah is telling, huh?
Or to other people.
Or the people that are hearing it. Or to the person that can't hear it and is still being abused, even if they don't hear it. So in other words, you could really look at it and all three are true. But so in other words, Torah is instructing us never to lose sight of a human being's dignity. It's never, and your own dignity. It's never okay to put down somebody just because you can.
But you don't take advantage of somebody else's disability. Cursing a deaf person is like putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person. A blind person can't see it.
Right.
You're capitalizing on his disability.
The only difference would be that when a blind person stumbles, it hurts. When a deaf person is cursed, you could say that it hurts.
Well, Tim is saying you can't. Sorry. I was just saying it can hurt the person. Your words can hurt that person.
Right.
You can't hear them and defend it. You're hitting where he can't, where he's disabled.
Where he can't defend, yeah. Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
I mean, you can read into it. The point is that even if he doesn't hear me, he can't do it. I mean, even if you're not hurting him personally.
Yeah.
That's
in some commentaries. I don't know if it's exactly text 3b, but some commentaries explain that that's the distinction between the two, is that even though it may never hurt the deaf person on some level, you can't do it. That's why it says, V'yareisa melekech ani Hashem. You shall fear your God. I am the Lord. Because there was someone like, I know what you did. It doesn't matter that he knows or doesn't know. I know what you did. Anyway, okay, let's take a look at text 3b, which is the Abar Benel's interpretation.
The verse tells us that the hearing person should not curse the deaf person, and the seeing person should not cause the blind person to trip on his path. This is a metaphor instructing any powerful person not to oppress those who are weaker. But this is an indication of poor character.
So he kind of strips it of the specifics, and he talks about powerful and weaker, and again, that's a judgment call. But in the context of this discussion, let's just, for the sake of argument, take those words at whatever value they have. And again, there's ways to... We have to be careful when we use these words. Measuring stronger or weaker. But notwithstanding that, the point is that just because somebody may appear disadvantaged does not allow another person to take advantage of that disadvantage. Right? And Torah understands that there is an evil tendency in the heart of man. There is a Yetzer Hara. There is an evil tendency in the heart of man to be cruel to those who appear disadvantaged. We know this to be true. We all went to school. We all went to school and we all knew or know or were the kid that got picked on. There are, because other kids sense if they sense, whether it's true or not, they sense that someone is disadvantaged on whatever, however it's understood, there's a weakness there, the kids jump on. Torah understands more acutely than any other work, because Torah is divine, what lies in the nature and the heart of a human being. And what lies, part of the ugly part of a human being's nature, is the desire on some level to pick out and pick on someone else's disadvantage. The Torah tells us you can't do it. Torah says you can't do it. Every time Torah says you can't do something, it means that there is a desire to do it. If there would not be a desire to do it, Torah would not have to tell us not to do it. That's a cardinal rule. If Torah says, don't do such and such, it means that at some point in time or on some level, the human being has a desire to do that. So Torah says, don't drink blood. Don't eat insects. It's because human beings, on some level, at a certain time, at a certain place, might have that desire. It doesn't ban some, doesn't forbid something that no one would ever want to do anyway. Then there's no point. So the fact that Torah forbids this cruelty of cursing a dead person, placing something black before a blind person, means that on some level, we are programmed, at least we're susceptible to doing that on some level. Okay. So Torah is teaching us that every human being has dignity. Every human being, without distinction, has dignity and must be treated in a dignified manner. So in this vein, getting back to our discussion of those who are mentally challenged, Jewish law, halacha, mandates various forms of protection for those who are not of sound mind and cannot make decisions for themselves. So Torah says, first of all, no one is allowed to take advantage of them. It would be in the same category of cursing a dead person and placing a stumbling block before the blind. You cannot take advantage of somebody that is otherwise mentally ill. But moreover, on a more practical level, the Jewish law says, as I mentioned before, that we need to appoint an apotrophos, which means a guardian for the mentally ill. So take a look at text 4, John.
The Beit Din should appoint a guardian for the mentally ill, just as they do for orphan minors, so that others do not loot their belongings.
So look at that. There needs to be a guardian, just like for orphan minors, that need a guardian to handle their affairs. And what's the reason? So that others do not loot their belongings. So who's so low to loot the belongings of an orphan minor or somebody who's mentally ill? That's the point. Not every, potentially everyone. In other words, who knows who? But the bottom line is that potential exists. And again, whether it's actually loot their belongings or in another way slight them, bottom line is, there needs to be protection. And again, practically, this protection is from a financial standpoint. You have somebody that's managing the affairs. But I will tell you that this guardian or custodian, steward, if you will, manages many areas for the mentally ill or for the orphan minor. Now, this quote is lifted from the Levush Chosha Mishpat. But yeah, this is all Talmudic. The quote that they happened to pick out was a concise, it fit nicely in the paragraph. But this is a Talmudic term. You're right, this is 1,600 years ago. I mean, this is...
No, this isn't 1,600, this is relatively new.
Oh, this... No, I thought you were going the other way. But it really... No, this is not relatively new.
No.
Apotrophos is discussed in the Talmud.
The
huh?
The word is self...
One second.
Is there any connection back to the Torah?
Yes. I know that the Mishnah and the Talmud certainly talk about this halachic concept.
It's as old as the Talmud.
It's as old as the first, let's put it this way. It's as old as the first recording of the oral law, which we understand to have been the recording of the oral law, which had been transmitted orally from teacher to student before it was penned, pen to ink. Ink to paper. Pen to ink and ink to paper. Yeah. Ink to parchment, feather to parchment, quill to parchment. So it's an old concept. It's an old concept. But what I think the point of this new ruling is that the mentally ill might have the same category as the orphan minor. We know in the Talmud that the orphan minor definitely needs this trustee or whatever, this guardian steward. that mentally ill are in the same category, it could be, I'm not sure, I haven't traced it back myself, it could be Talmudic, it could be a clear adaptation from that concept. Apotrophus, it's right there. Based on Amidim Apotrophus. Yeah, sounds Greek.
So that's going to mean it's about 2,000 years old.
No, the word is 2,000 years
old. No, the word is, but you can, the concept.
Yeah. I believe it's
starting around there, which goes back to when the oral law was written.
I don't know for sure that it's Greek. It's definitely Aramaic. It's definitely from the Talmudic time. It might be in a.
The word is Greek.
Could be.
And it would go back.
Reminds me of the story of Hanukkah. Yeah,
well, you know, there's the other terms that we use that come from synagogue, is actually. Synagogues, pronunciation, Apocorus.
Yeah.
There are all these other Epicurus, words that come from that period.
Yep.
So it goes back, and it's the modern day conservatorship, which is what we have here in Georgia, is what this is. So that whole system, in a way, the concept is a Jewish concept.
Right.
That we use in the system.
It's a very Jewish, and again, it comes from the biblical law of protecting the interests of those who might be taken advantage of. It's a very clear concept, and it has a very definitive halachic ruling that goes along with it. Now, I just want to highlight one other interesting law regarding those who are mentally ill. Text 5, very interesting law. Dr. Safra, could you please read this?
One who wounds another person is obligated to pay monetary compensation on 5 counts: damage, pain, medical expenses, loss of income due to being unable to work, and embarrassment. Regarding people who suffer from insanity, one who harms them is obliged to pay compensation, whereas they are exempt for the damage they cause.
Here you have what's called a chiddush, a novelty. In Jewish law, there's always liability. If you do something, if you damage, you always are liable. The Mishnah says, Adam mu'ad le'olam, a person is always liable, bein ar, bein yashin, whether they're awake or sleeping, whether it's intentional or unintentional, if you're sleeping, you're in somebody's house, in the middle of the night, you roll over and you smash the lamp. I was sleeping, I didn't mean to do it, I'm so sorry. You're still liable. It doesn't make a difference whether the intent was there or not. If the damage was done, the damage was done. And if you did it, you're liable. However, the big exception here is somebody suffering from a mental illness. So we say that they are protected against others damaging them. So if one damages somebody who is mentally ill, one is obligated to pay that compensation, whereas they are exempt for the damage they caused to others. Halacha does not hold them accountable for their actions. Again, it holds everybody accountable for their actions, whether intentional or not. In typical circumstances, but the exception is somebody who doesn't have that mental capacity to be in control of themselves, Jewish law actually absolves them of any liability for damages.
Is this like an insanity defense? Or that's
it might be. It's not a defense, really. Yeah, it's. I guess it sounds similar.
Talking about civil liability.
Yeah, civil liability, torts, you know, damages, that sort of thing. But it's a similar concept. The concept is that if somebody is understood to be in the halachic categorization, which we haven't broken down, we're not really going to get into, you know, how halacha defines the different categories. But if somebody is in the category of what's called a shota, then they don't have that. Shoteh, they don't have that liability at all. But again, somebody who damages them would be liable. So there's an interesting discussion question on page 158. You'll see right there, question for discussion. Might these laws seeking to protect the mentally ill also create some disadvantages for them? Let's think about that. What is that? Right. So in other words, in trying to protect these individuals, the flip side is you're robbing them of their independence. Right? If you have somebody handling their affairs to make sure they're not being looted and taken advantage of, at the same time, you're taking away their freedom, which could be a painful experience. And if you allow their actions to not have any repercussions. From a liability standpoint, you might further encourage people to remain distant from them and not get close to them. Huh? Hard to get a job. If whatever they do, if there's no liability or responsibility for what they do, then who wants to be part of that situation? So what the point that I want to bring out, and the point that's really we're trying to bring out here, is that Jewish law is seeking the welfare of everybody, seeking to protect the dignity of every human being, and including, as we're talking about, the mentally ill. And so the court, the Bet Din, the Jewish court, and the poskim, the halachic experts, will have to weigh the advantages versus liabilities. In other words, what's more beneficial to this individual? If we take away their ability to make their own decisions and put it in the hands of somebody else, will that benefit them more? Or will that rob them of their self-esteem? Or we give them the power to make decisions, even though knowing that they might mess up and it might be bad, but at least they have their own dignity. And so it'll depend on every case is different. Every individual case will have its own criteria, have its own factors, and this decision will be unique. But again, it's all about weighing what is in the best interest of preserving the humanity, the dignity of the individual. So if it's taking away, stripping their control, if it's taking away their liability for what they do, then fine. If not, not. But again, we're trying to protect that individual. So that's as far as looking who gets the guardian, who gets the protection. Who gets it? Somebody who needs it, and it has to be carefully weighed. But in addition to looking at who gets the guardian, we need to look at what sort of decisions can the guardian make on behalf of the person that is in their charge. This becomes a critical question to consider. Again, we're dealing with a situation where there's a person who is not able to make their own choices, whether they're not able to understand or comprehend or whatever it is, they're not able to render their own decision on issues. So therefore, we have an appointed guardian. By the way, who's a guardian? Who would Jewish law appoint as a guardian for somebody who is, God forbid, mentally ill? A parent is a good choice.
Brother, sister.
Yeah, family member, a loved one. Or it would have to be a third party, that is, if in the absence of family, that could do that. Somebody that is really all about the welfare of that individual. But somebody, obviously, that loves that person, cares for them, and wants to choose based on their best interest. So, again, the question we're going to deal with now, and it sounds like a simple question, as we'll see, it's not simple at all, is what sort of choices can that guardian make on behalf of that individual? Are there any restrictions on the choices that person can make? So here's the general rule. The general rule is that the guardian, the steward, if you will, may only act to the benefit of the person that is in their charge. Can only act to benefit. This becomes very critical. To benefit that person. This concept is really derived from the Mishnah of the Talmud. Text 6a becomes becomes an important text here. Liz, will you please read this? Text 6a.
We may act to bring benefit to a person who is absent. We are not permitted to make decisions that are disadvantageous to a person who is absent.
Okay, this is not talking about guardians and the mentally ill. This is talking about something completely different. The Mishnah says, in general, if somebody is not present, if somebody is not there, somebody else can act on their behalf if it's something that is to their advantage. So, for example, look at that, files are backed up.
Okay. I understood it to mean absent this way.
No, that's how we're going to apply it, but that's not what it literally means. Here's the principle. You have three people sitting in a room, okay, and then the Mishnah pops up. No. Then somebody throws a whole pile of stack of cash their way. Okay? So, what the halacha is, that these people can acquire the money on behalf of a party who is not present. And we consider, once they pick it up, once they pick up the cash, oh, I'm taking some money for Shmerel, who's not here. So halachically, Shmerel makes the kinyan, makes the acquisition, and is considered to actually own the money. To the point that if somebody takes it out of their hand, theoretically you could argue as follows. If you really want to get into this again. If theoretically you can argue like this. So again, somebody drops money, and everyone takes some money, and there's some money left over. So I say, okay, I have enough for me. I'm holding this for my good friend Shmerel. Somebody then comes and rips it out of my hand. Is he stealing? He might not be stealing, because I never acquired it for myself. And if halachically Shmerel doesn't acquire it either, that means I'm holding it, but it's really ownerless, so that means that the party that takes it actually is not stealing. Does that make any sense? Doesn't make any sense, right?
If he picked it up before the other.
That's correct. Does that make sense what I just said?
It's not stealing from Shmerel?
No. I'm saying if you don't say this, then, right, in absence of this, this is why the law becomes critical. Again, theoretically, without this law, and you say that, so again, I'm picking up the money, I say it's for Shmerel. If we don't have this law, in other words, if my act of acquisition on behalf of Shmerel does not actually cause Shmerel to be the owner of this money that he doesn't even know about, then that means when I'm holding it, it doesn't belong to me because I don't have that intentionality. It doesn't belong to Shmerel because it can't, because he doesn't have it in his hand. That means it belongs to nobody, it happens to be in my hand. So third party rips it off, it's his. So halacha says that's not true. Halacha says when I pick it up for somebody else, zachin la adam shalei befanav, it belongs to him. I can benefit. Zachin, I can be zoche. Zoche means it's a good translation. Zoche, benefit, privilege. La adam, somebody shalei befanav without him being present. I pick it up on his behalf. Now I cannot sell his stocks in Apple without his consent. It doesn't work. I can't, assuming that selling shares of Apple is a negative thing, I can't harm somebody without, you know, if I try to harm somebody and they're not there, it doesn't mean, it doesn't actually work, it doesn't actually go. But I can halakhically benefit somebody without them being there. Now, let's apply this to the other case of, quote, absence, which is a case where somebody is not absent in the decision-making process because they're not mentally capable of making such decisions. So, what we learn from this text is that somebody who is acting in stewardship, somebody who's acting as a guardian on behalf of somebody who's mentally ill, is only allowed to make choices or choose things that benefit that individual and not something that harms that individual. Does that make sense? This, you might say that sounds obvious. Obviously, he, on behalf of the person that he's trying to protect, he can't harm him. Obviously, Rabbi, what are you saying? I'll tell you what I'm saying. What I'm saying is even a situation where everyone in the world would make a choice, it's possible that the steward cannot make the choice on behalf of the individual who is mentally ill. Even though everybody else of sound mind would make that choice, you cannot make the choice on behalf of somebody else. What I'm talking about is a choice that ultimately benefits somebody else, but does not benefit yourself. And you'll see what I mean soon.
Being a situation where 10 out of 10 people would agree to be selfless.
Correct. Would agree to endure pain and hardship to save a life.
Okay.
But the guardian is not allowed to make that choice on behalf of that mentally ill individual because it's not for their benefit. Again, this is the way we understand the halachic ramifications or halachic definition of the guarantor. Is the guarantor is only allowed to act in the direct benefit of the person that they are charged to protect, in their benefit, not in the benefit of a party that's going to benefit from the actions of the person that they're. You have to understand this is going to hit so many different points and go back to the issue of my sister's keeper. It's going to touch on this absolutely directly. I'll ask you a very simple question. Can a parent choose for a child to donate an organ? Why not? It's saving a life. Wait a second. Can the parent choose Because the child is not of the ability to make that choice. So who's making the call? The parent. Halachically, is a parent allowed to say that my child should undergo pain and a difficult procedure even to save a life? Even to, but of course everyone would do that. But again, as the guardian, the guardian is only allowed to look for the benefit of that person, not for the benefit of. I hope this makes sense. So let's discuss this issue. The case study one is all about organ donation. It's a powerful story. And just to set it up again, we learned in lesson two that organ donation is in many cases permissible but not obligatory. In the case of kidney donation, that was true. So donating a kidney is not obligated. It's not forbidden, but rather it's permitted. It's permissible. If you want to, you can. If you don't want to, you don't have to. So, but what happens when the only donor available is somebody who has limited mental capacity? So they cannot consent to the surgery themselves. Can the guardian consent to it on their behalf? That's case study number one. Leonard, you ready? Go for it. Strunk.
Yep. Strunk. Tommy Strunk was 28 years old in 1969 and died of fatal kidney disease. Only a transplant could save his life. Doctors considered the possibility of using a kidney or a cadaver if and when one became available, or one from a live donor if a donor could be found. His mother, father, and a number of other relatives were tested. Because of incompatibility of blood type or tissue, none were medically acceptable as live donors. His brother, Jerry Strunk, was the only member of his extended family who was found to be an acceptable organ match. But Jerry, though he idolized Tommy, was confined to a state mental hospital. His mental age had been assessed at approximately 6 years. Even if he had fully understood the crisis, Jerry was mentally incompetent to authorize surgery on himself. Jerry's mother went to court to get permission, and the surgery was approved. But then Jerry's guardian attempted to overturn the decision, arguing that the surgery was not in Jerry's best interest. The question before the Court of Appeals was whether the court could grant the request of Jerry's mother to permit a kidney to be removed from an incompetent ward of the state in order to save his brother. The majority opinion made the following arguments in support of allowing the transplant. Tom's best chance for survival was receiving a kidney from his brother. The risk to Jerry as a donor were relatively slight. Jerry could be harmed by Tom's death because despite his disability, Jerry showed emotional reactions. He frequently asked about Tom's movements. While Jerry might not understand the details of Tom's kidney failure, Jerry was aware that he played a role in the relief of the current tension about Tom's health. Were Tom to die, Jerry would be burdened with guilt. The dissenting judge made the following arguments. While parents may become martyrs themselves, it does not follow that they are free, in identical circumstances, to make martyrs of the children before they reach the age of legal discretion to make that choice for themselves. The ability to understand and consent is a prerequisite for the donation of part of the human body. There was no guarantee that the transplant would save Tom's life. The body frequently rejects transplanted organs. While the surgery would not endanger Jerry's life, it did contain some risks. The permission of the court was based on the fact that there would be psychological benefits to the ward. However, the ward had the mental mentality of a six-year-old child. It is common knowledge beyond dispute that the loss of a close relative of a six-year-old child is not of major impact. Opinions concerning psychological trauma are, at best, nebulous.
All right, so, It's complicated. It's horrible. It's complicated. By the way, as we read, the majority opinion of the Court of Appeals was that it was permitted. It was permitted. There was a dissenting judge. So I'll ask you the question. Do you agree with the majority opinion or the minority opinion of the court? Why? What do you think are the key factors in making this decision?
We have to, I would more loosely define the benefit of the mentally affected ward.
Yeah.
A little more loosely than you, but I would say that if there was a decision where 10 out of 10 normal people would make X decision, even if it wasn't obviously in the direct benefit of that person, but the person making the decision for that person, it would be to that person's benefit that somebody allowing him to act the same way that the 10 out of 10 people would normally act. That's to his benefit.
How does that benefit him?
Because if he was normal, he'd be acting like the other 10 people. And what you're doing is you're enabling him to act in a normal fashion. Would it be permissible?
But that doesn't directly, that benefits his stature, that benefits his...
No. Benefits
his body, his health.
It benefits him.
It's putting him at risk.
It benefits him to act the way that 10 out of, now if you tell me 6 out of 10 people, you know that's what I'm, but you just tell me, you set something up where 10 out of 10 people would say this, then I think the person making the decision for him would have the obligation to make the decision the way those 10.
I hear your argument. I hear your argument.
He would make it for himself and for 10 out of 10 people.
I hear your argument, but I don't know, as we'll see in text 7, the poskim don't hold that in consideration. They talk about literally the physical benefit of that individual.
So you couldn't make a decision to get tzedakah for him.
Correct. You talk about even the mitzvah to save a life. You can even go a step further. It's a mitzvah to save a life. You cannot use that as a compelling argument to say it's in the best interest to allow that person to do the mitzvah of saving a life. Think about that. If the decision is made on behalf of Jerry to donate his kidney, so Jerry has performed the mitzvah of saving a life because it's because of his kidney that Tom's life is saved. It's halachically problematic to use that argument and therefore say, well, now we're acting in his best interest because from a mitzvah perspective, he doesn't want to do a mitzvah. Of course he would want to do that mitzvah. It's a very, in the words of Auerbach, he says,
you're making the decision for him the way he would have made it for himself.
That's correct. And that's halakhically questionable. Yeah, that's not considered on a very strict...
I'm sure there are minority
posts. Alright, well, I don't know. I mean, let's do this. Let's take... But I want to get back to the second question that I asked. Forget which opinion you agree with. What's going to be the critical analysis in this case that a bet din, that a halachic court of law would look at?
Is there a detriment to...
And which... Give me numbers of the arguments. Right? We had four one way, four the other way. Give me the numbers of the key arguments either way.
To Jerry, a slight...
Where is that?
Number two.
Wow, the risk to Jerry is slight. All right, but how is that to his benefit? That still doesn't argue that it's to his benefit. That argues that it's not so much to his harm. But again, the only choices that this steward can make on behalf of his charge or his ward is to the benefit, not to his not so much harm, but directly benefiting that individual. How is it to his benefit? Huh? Three and four of the majority opinions say that it is benefiting him, because if his brother dies, it's going to hurt him. So it's directly benefiting him to have him donate his kidney to save his brother, because otherwise he's going to be hurt. And the key opinion the other way would be number four again, which is that number four, the other way, in the minority opinion, the dissenting judge says, are you kidding me? They get over it right away, six-year-olds. It doesn't dramatically affect them and destroy their lives. On the contrary, a young child gets over death fairly quickly. So you're telling me that it's to his best interest to save his brother's life, otherwise he'll be irreparably destroyed? Not at all. That will be the key critical analysis of the court. Of the other factors, how risky it is, this risky, not so risky, that's not so much of an issue. The issue is, is this benefiting Jerry, or is it not benefiting him? And so, but let's read it inside. Text 7 is a similar case from halakhic literature. It's a similar case, and this is the source of the arguments that I've been putting forth. Ben, take it away, text 7.
A bone marrow transplant is extremely painful to the donor, to the extent that the donor must be put under general anesthesia while the bone marrow is harvested. Rabbi S. Z. Auerbach told me that it is permitted to use a child as a donor to save the life of a terminally ill family member, so long as the child is mature and understanding.
In other words, there must be consent from the child. The child has to be of the ability to understand and consent. Continue.
If the child is the only available donor but has not reached the age of mature understanding, it is very questionable if the parents have the right to consent on behalf of the child to save a family member by applying the principle, we benefit a person in their absence, to assert that it is a great benefit for the donor to save another's life.
You see what he says here? He says, if the only donor available is the child that has not yet reached the age of maturity and understanding, so he says, quote, very questionable. In other words, the assumption is that it's not okay for the parents to consent on behalf of that child by applying the principle, we benefit a person in their absence. In other words, how would we apply the principle? By saying, no, it's to their benefit to allow them to do the mitzvah of saving another person's life. The child is benefiting because the child has the opportunity to do a mitzvah to save a life. To use that logic, to use that argument, and say therefore it's in the benefit, therefore the parent can consent to a painful and difficult procedure, is iyun tzarich iyun gadol. He says requires great. It's very questionable, and it requires a great stretch to make that assumption. So therefore, the assumption is that it's not okay. He doesn't outright forbid it, by the way, but he says it's very, very questionable to allow it.
Accepted age of understanding?
No, it's pretty much a what's it called again? A sliding scale, depending on the analysis of the court that has their own way measure of figuring that out. So where does this leave us? This leaves us like this. So I want to bring out the same point. In other words, even if you're going to argue, well, anyone would donate, any person would consent to giving some of their bone marrow to save a life. It's a family member. If this child was 3 years older and understood what was going on, of course they would want to. So why can't the parent make that choice now? Because the parent is only allowed to act to the benefit or in the benefit of their child. Directly their child, not the other family member. And if this is painful, if this is something difficult, then it becomes problematic to do so. So the issue is not what would they do if they were able to make the decision. In other words, the question is not what would the child do if the child was able to make the decision. That's not the question. Because if that was the question, the answer might be, go ahead. That's not the question. The question is, what's directly in their best interest? That's the only question we look at. And one there, and halakhically, one cannot take action unless it's clear and proven that it is within their direct best interest, i.e. the direct best interest of the one whom they're acting, whom they're choosing on behalf of.
No, I understand for an appointed guardian. This is the same for a parent and a child?
That's right. A parent has the same status.
Isn't a parent permitted to teach his child moral lessons? Give tzedakah, for example, if it doesn't benefit the child directly?
Not if it harms.
Giving away the money, huh? I mean, right?
On one level, it's not the same. It's not the same. I hear what you're saying.
I mean, okay, so that was an example, wasn't it? I mean,
right. Oh, yeah, I hear what you're saying. No, the question is if the child, you know what, let's use that argument. A child, you might argue, doesn't own any property. All the property that a minor owns halakhically belongs to the parent anyway. So, I'm getting you on a technicality. I'm saying, but I don't know if there's another example. No, I understand your question, but I don't know if there's another example. I know you're trying to differentiate between a parent and a guardian, because a parent should have more control over. We see, again, you know, we can argue, but we see here that the halachic authorities are saying very questionable to allow a parent to make that decision. A parent needs to act only. In other words, halachically, the only time someone, anybody, can make a decision for somebody else, whether they're a guardian appointed by the court, whether they're a parent, if you're making a decision, if you're allowed to make a decision for somebody else, the only decision that you can make is one that is benefiting that person directly. It's teaching them the value of education. It's saving a life. It's allowing them to perform a mitzvah. He says that I know that argument, and it's questionable. It's very, very problematic to say so. So as I said before, the key point in Jerry's case would be, is this in his best interest? Because whoever's pulling the strings here and making that choice has to act in the best interest of Jerry. So the question is, what will be in Jerry's best interest? Is it to go through this and save his brother?
That's where the difficulty comes to that question. What's the standard?
Is correct.
Is it a reasonable person? Is it as if the person was a parent? No, it's weighing the factors. It's just a big difficulty.
It's not what would they have done. That's not the consideration. The consideration is not what would they have done or what would anybody do. That's not the consideration. Is what's right now in their physical best interest.
But that's what I'm getting at. There's that balancing act, which do the negatives outweigh the positives? What weight do you put to each of the factors?
Right. So
that's the great difficulty.
Right.
From there, so you've got to have a standard to sort out how do you
I'm with
weigh
you.
Each one of these.
I'm with you. Yeah, there definitely all the factors would have to be discussed. But this is the nature of the discussion that's going to take place. Can we consider this in Jerry's best interest, or is this anyone would martyr, quote unquote, go through this, endure this pain for greater gain. So let's choose this for Jerry also, but it's not in his best interest.
You also get the thing, okay, short-term benefit or long-term benefit versus the detriment.
But it has to be, we have to weigh this regarding Jerry himself, not for anybody else that's benefiting from Jerry, from this action.
Well, Jerry, okay, Jerry may have the short-term detriment. It hurts to
right.
have surgery.
But his brother will be around to take care of him.
Benefit,
I'm with you.
You know, and then it could be flipped.
If his brother is gonna outlive the parents and he'll be able to take care of him for many long years, if he gets the kidney, that might be in consideration. Maybe it is acting in Jerry's best interest to pull. I'm with you. But this is the discussion. I'm not saying it's going to go either way. I'm saying, but this is the discussion that's going to take place. Yeah.
If Tommy wasn't 28 years old and the parent had to decide for both minors, how would it have gone?
That's a good question. So the quick answer is they could obviously consent to Tommy getting the thing, the organ, because that's directly in Tommy's best interest. That benefits the recipient. The donor doesn't benefit the donor. Doesn't benefit the donor. It hurts the donor. How does it benefit the donor? Unless you say, because the brother's death would hurt him more than the pain that he's getting from this. But again, that has to be evaluated, and we have to create some standards for that in the courts, which I'm sure would. But so could they consent to the minor receiving? Absolutely, because it benefits. Can they consent to somebody paining themselves to save someone else? It becomes questionable. So I brought up the book and the movie My Sister's Keeper earlier. So, you know, in the story, is everybody familiar with that? I wasn't before this course started, but I am now. Yeah. I YouTubed it and watched the trailer, huh? I have no idea. I saw the trailer and I read it on Wikipedia, so I got like the Cliff Notes version. Basically,
it's from Little Miss Sunshine.
And the story is that the couple has a daughter, and the daughter is, what does she have? She has something. She's dying of something, and so therefore they have another child with the intention to take whatever they need. From the one child, from the one girl to the other girl. So they do blood transfusions, they take the marrow out, and then when she turns 13, at that point the sister needs a new, I don't know, what was it, a kidney? I don't know, she needs some sort of organ. And they say, okay, now it's time for you to give up your kidney. And she says, I'm 13, and I don't want to. And she, in the book, in the movie, she actually goes to an attorney to have her emancipated from her parents, so that her parents don't have the right to tell her that she has to go through with this. So it becomes a whole court battle, and I'm not going to ruin the ending. But anyway, the bottom line is, point is, this concept is questionable from the get-go. From the get-go, can the parents make the decision that one child should endure pain for the other child's benefit? Again, a parent that makes a choice for a child, it has to be for the benefit of that child. Not saying that it won't be okay, I'm saying we have to think about it in these terms. Not what's in the benefit of the other. Yeah.
What was Breut saying in a different context back in this article where he's, last week, where he said, it's totally okay. He was speaking to the issue of whether or not you could conceive a child with the motivation that you would be donating certain things
right.
to that child.
Right.
And he said totally okay.
Right.
Because you're just doing two mitzvahs.
Right,
you're
two separate things.
Bringing a child into the world, totally fine. And you're saving a life, totally fine. Your other motivation is irrelevant.
The quest, so when it comes to blood and other things, but again, when it comes to making a choice that's painful for that child, can you, is it automatic that you can say, make the choice that's paining this individual because it's benefiting somebody else? I want to give you another case.
Right, so blood, different from kidney.
Possibly. A kidney, there would have to be considerations as where's the benefit to the child? To that child that you're pulling the kidney out of. Show me the benefit. If you can't show me the benefit, if you can't argue the benefit for that child, you cannot do it. Because you can only choose for someone else that which is beneficial to them. So throw me some arguments. It benefits them that what? That they're doing a mitzvah? Questionable if that works. They're benefiting them that what? That they have a continued relationship with their sibling? Perhaps. But again, let's go. But we have to argue with these terms. You can't say, well, anybody's going to make this decision. If she was older, she would, so I'm going to make it for her. That's not how it works. That's not how it works. That's not the argument. That can't be the argument. I think what will really bring this out a much starker way is case study 2, which I'm not going to read. Case study 2, I'm going to summarize. There was a place called Willowbrook State School in Staten Island. It was an institution. It was for children suffering from severe mental disabilities. And they had hepatitis outbreaks, which they didn't really understand. And medical staff was brought in. They wanted to do studies. To study hepatitis. Here was a contained environment, and they obviously figured they had mentally ill children, might as well just pull them into the study. What they did was they took 700 children. They split them up into different groups. They all gave, I'm just going to cut to the chase here, they gave them an antibody, some sort of vaccine that would help against the effects of hepatitis. And then they purposefully exposed them to hepatitis, to watch the reaction. Okay, so, and by the way, how they did it is horrifying, how they exposed them to hepatitis, by feeding them infected feces. So, but this is what happened. This is 1955. Okay. So they found differences between hepatitis A and hepatitis B. I mean, they made big strides in understanding hepatitis, and it's benefited society since this study. So we've all benefited from that study. Okay. Here's the question. The questions we're going to deal with: what are the ethical arguments in favor for the study, and what are the ethical arguments against the study?
Part of the study was giving them the antibodies.
Correct.
They didn't know if that was going to be harmful or helpful. So there's justification for that because, you know, you're trying to help them.
Right. So giving the antibodies, giving the antibody,
that part
makes sense because if hepatitis is going around, so you think you're taking beneficial measures to protect, so you give them that antibody. You're not sure, but your intention is to benefit. Yeah, and that's right. So you're trying. You don't think it's going to kill them, but you're trying to help them. You're benefiting. You're acting on their. You're choosing for them, but it's to their benefit. Fine, but intentionally giving them something that's going to. Now, so that becomes problematic. Again, why? You can't argue that while it's going to benefit others, through research, we're going to figure out. Again, what you're choosing here is choosing to harm one individual for the benefit of another individual. Even if an individual would make a choice to say, I will donate myself to science, harm myself, not kill myself. That's not halakhically okay. I'm willing to undergo pain for medical science. Is that okay? Is that halakhically permitted? Let's take a look. It's part of this discussion. Text 8. I'm going to read this quickly. If doctors are confident that there is no danger involved in the experiment that is being proposed, it is permitted to volunteer one's body to participate in a clinical trial that will benefit other patients. And indeed, one is considered to have performed a mitzvah. However, there are certainly no grounds to suggest that the Torah would consider it an obligation at all. Here again, we have a situation where if you donated your body to medical science, if you volunteer yourself, and again, the caveat here is that it's not danger. When I say not danger, what does that mean? Not painful or not dangerous? Not dangerous. It's painful. It might be painful. It might be difficult. It might be uncomfortable. But when we say not dangerous, what we mean is mortal danger. Now, the threat, let's go back to the case with the kids at that Willowbrook place. What they exposed the children to was not life-threatening. Let's say they only expose the children to hepatitis A, which is not life-threatening. Hepatitis A. It's for a few days, it's bad, it's miserable, but it's not chronic. Hepatitis A. Let's just say. Would that be okay? Again, for somebody themselves to give their body to medical experimentation for medical science to benefit others, when there's no, if there's a danger, you know how to do it. Unless your life is threatened, and the only way to do it is through an experimental medicine. And we had a few classes ago that some would say it's okay. But again, if your life is not threatened in the present, to put yourself in a life-threatening situation, not good. What about a painful situation to benefit others? You can if you want to. There's no obligation, but it's certainly a mitzvah to do so. You benefited others. You were a martyr on some level, not to the point of giving up your life, but you've sacrificed some health for benefiting others. Mazel tov. It's a beautiful thing.
Permissible.
But can one make that choice for somebody else? For you yourself, huh?
For someone with severe mental disabilities.
That's the question. So even though for a person themselves to make that choice might be permissible, but can the guardian, who's supposed to be looking out for their best interest, make that choice for them? Certainly seems highly problematic. Highly questionable. Like, almost surely not okay. According to Jewish law, according to any body of ethics, to say that let's go there where the kids can't make their own choices, and you know the parents are trusting us, and that's where we're going to do the experimentation.
A prison would be okay though,
if they consent.
Yeah.
If you consent, unless it's something that could be fatal, then you can't do that. And Torah doesn't allow you to play Russian roulette. But to do something where the doctors say, oh, look, anything could be fatal. But where doctors say, this is hepatitis A. This is what's going to happen. It's going to be miserable for this amount of time. Then you're going to get better. We just want to see the reaction based on having the antibody before, not having the antibody, this situation, that situation. You're allowed to do that. But you can't choose it for somebody else. It's going to benefit society, mankind, all of history from that point on. You can't make that choice. Your choice only has to be focused solely on the benefit of that individual, not on somebody else's benefit. So, text 9 really captures this concept. All right. Lynn, would you please read text 9?
Regarding experimentation on a child or mentally incompetent person, if there is no discomfort or pain to the child, there is no problem with examining his natural bodily secretion, such as urine or stool samples. Likewise, if doctors are in any case taking blood for medical purposes, it is permissible to take a little extra for the use of study.
So, number one, he says, is like this. So, again, you're not acting necessarily in their benefit, but it's natural body secretions, it's a little extra blood. In other words, there's no harm happening to the child or to the person. Okay, continue.
If the experiment itself will cause pain to the child, if the experiment is for the child's benefit in a way that the child will gain directly from the study's results, it would seem that the study may be done so long as the pain or discomfort involved is minor, relying on the rule that we benefit someone in their absence. However, if the study will cause pain or discomfort, and only others will benefit from the results of the study, but not the child, then the child's body may not be used. If there is danger in the actual experiment, if the danger is small compared to the benefits that the subject will gain from the experiment, it is permitted to do it, for in every treatment there is some risk which is permitted when the expected benefit from the procedure is greater than the risks. However, if the risks are great, or if the benefit will be only for other patients, it is forbidden to conduct the study on the child, regardless of whether there is parental consent.
And you see in the question for discussion immediately after, based on this text, do you think the Willowbrook study would be considered ethical by a rabbinical court? The answer is no, because it's harming them, and it's not benefiting them. There's no way it's okay. You can argue, well, maybe they had a benefit of being put in a better facility. We didn't read the case inside, but there's pretty much no arguments that that could be used as to justify that study. Now,
how do you organize like the rule where we say you can break any rule to save a life, and now say, except for the big three, but now really there's like a big four, there's a fourth. Is it a fourth, or is it an exception to the exception?
I was thinking this question also. In other words, because now the guardian has a rule to protect the interests of the charge of that mentally ill or person or the child. So, but maybe me, let's say I'm the guardian, I should violate my mitzvah to look out for their welfare, to save that person's life, and set them into surgery to pull out their organ to save that person's life. Maybe that's my mitzvah. Uh-huh. Unless we say that my mitzvah as a guardian supersedes my mitzvah to save a life. And now that becomes a fourth. That was a loop that I was stuck in today. So I don't have an answer. I'm still stuck in it. I was hoping it wouldn't come up.
Sorry.
There might be...
Shared mental illness.
Yeah, well, there might be a situation where you draw a line between, and my brain gets fuzzy every time I try to think of this. Like it squeezes it a little too hard. There might be a line between.
No. You're not even required to give your own kid to save a life.
Right. That's true. Right. There's no mitzvah. That's true. There's no mitzvah too. But if you do it, it's a mitzvah. But you're not obligated. That's right. That's right. There you go. There's no mitzvah too. Because it causes... Right, so you could really have asked the question before when we said that there's no obligation to if it causes discomfort or if it pulls out an organ. You could have asked the question, so it's a fourth thing that you're... But obviously, right, this goes back to the thing. You don't have to put your own life in at risk to save a life. So in this case, where somebody's life is being put at risk, there's really no mitzvah to save a life. That makes sense.
Life is supposed to be not really...
But there's an organ being pulled out.
Right.
So that goes to the amputation thing.
It's certainly not required risk.
We'll change,
right.
Change the context from organs and talk about money.
So blood, yes.
You're in charge of this ward's money, and that money can be used to save his brother's life for a surgery.
Right, and let's say the money's never going to come back.
The money's never going to come back.
That's a good question. I might be tempted, I don't know. I'm gonna sit on that question. But thank you for clearing that up. Yeah, it would not be it would be a very good distinction. In other words, in this case, you're saving a life, whatever, but there's no obligation to.
I don't know that there's an obligation to
bankrupt yourself. Well, not bankrupt, but there is an obligation. We said the money. Remember, we had the whole Tosfot thing with the money. We only learned that personal effort and money, but not personal risk to one's health. It was a whole complicated thing, Text 7, like the class number one. But yeah, so money is required. We are required to spend money, even without expectation of getting it back to save life. But certainly not health, not putting our own health at risk. And that would extend to putting someone else's health at risk to save another party. So I would do it myself. I'm sure if he was of sound mental capacity, he would make the choice himself. Doesn't make a difference. So I want that. This is going to lead itself into text 10a, which is a powerful text. And I'm sure you've all heard of the first part. It's the second part that you probably never heard of. And the commentary on it is something that I would imagine is novel and it's profound. I'm going to read this quickly, text 10a. The verse says, famous verse, the golden rule, love your fellow like yourself. Rabbi Akiva said, this is a great principle in Torah. Ben Azai said, here's the follow-up. We never hear this one. Ben Azai said, quote from Genesis, this is the narrative of the generations of man on the day that God created man in the likeness of God He created him. This is a greater principle. Ben Azai says, as great a principle as love your fellow as yourself is, a greater principle is that God created the human being in His image. So what does that mean? What's Rabbi Akiva saying? What's Ben Azai is saying, I gotcha. I'll raise your love, your fellow as yourself, and, I don't know, gambling terminology, and I'll something you. Whatever. I'm raising the stakes because I have a verse that's trumping your verse. What does it mean? Here's what it means. Text 10b. This is according to the Ravid. Because from the first verse, we only learn to love another like yourself. So a person who has been shamed or cursed or was a victim of theft or had been beaten might think that it's permissible to let his friend be shamed or cursed or beaten in the same way. Therefore, the Torah says, in the likeness of God He created him, as if to say, who are you shaming? Who are you cursing? One created in the image of God. That's why the verse is a greater principle than the first. In other words, based on the first, I would have said, if I can be a martyr in a certain situation, I love you like me, you should also be a martyr in this situation. So forget the Ravid's shot. Forget his interpretation. Let's bring it back to our case. I might say, I'm looking out for this other individual. That individual can't make their own decisions, so I'm the one pulling the strings here. So for me, I would make such and such decision. So if I love my fellow as myself, I'll make the same decision for him. He'll make the same decision that I would have made. There's another verse. The verse is that every individual is created in the image of God. So just because you would have harmed yourself, been a martyr or whatever, endured pain to save someone else, doesn't mean that he has to, or doesn't mean that you're allowed to put that decision in his mouth or pull those strings for him. Because he too has his own individual. He has the right to have his best interests protected, his health protected, etc. So this is a powerful point. The point is that just because I would have done it, doesn't mean that I can choose that for him. The final point in the class, which we don't have time to develop at all, is, there's one point. The one point is the power of inclusion. With regards to those that are on some level mentally ill, and again, there's different variations of degrees of this, but what is their obligation vis-a-vis Torah and mitzvot? So it depends. Again, it depends. But there are certain individuals that because of their severe mental state, severe state of mental illness, they're not obligated at all in any Torah mitzvot. Somebody who just has severe learning challenges or otherwise a challenge. So the idea typically is teach them as much as they can and grow them along in Torah mitzvot to the best of their ability. And you know, whatever you can get, you can get. What about somebody who's not at all required to do anything? There's still value in inclusion. There's still value in bringing them into the community and allowing them to participate on any level that they can possibly participate. And even though this concept is perhaps scoffed at by some therapists, studies have shown that that there is great benefit for a mentally ill patient in having a sense of spiritual satisfaction, spiritual fulfillment, and a sense of community and belonging. These things are very therapeutic, bless you, for an individual struggling with mental illness. There's a powerful letter written by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and I encourage everyone to read this in the additional readings. It's in the additional readings, you'll see it there. It's small text, so I didn't lay it out. I apologize in advance for the small text. It lends itself to not be read. But I'm telling, it's worth the read. It's a letter from a doctor to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rebbe's response back to the doctor. The doctor's response back to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe's response back. So it's like back and forth, four letters, separate letters. And then a letter that addresses a conference. Powerful, when I say powerful, I cannot emphasize how powerful these letters are. especially the words of the rabbi. But this is a quote from that in text 13. There is surely no need to emphasize, page 172, at length that as in all cases involving Jews, their specific Jewish needs must be taken into account. This is particularly true in the case of, and again, I must, as a caveat here, the language that was used, this letter was written in 79, I guess, was the first letter. They used the word retarded. That was the word that was being used then. Today, we typically do not use that word. But in preservation of the letter, the way it was written, they chose to not edit the letter down and make it more modern, more current. But if you look in the letter, this is the letter that the medical professional is, this is the term that the medical professional is using in writing to the rabbi. The rabbi is responding back. But by the way, in the letter, if you, I must point this out even before I do this. I don't have the book. I don't have the same additional readings. But take a look over here, page 179, second paragraph, second line. The Rebbe writes that in his opinion, it should not be called by any other term other than special. 179, right-hand column. You see that? This is in 1979 or 1981. 179, right-hand column. Special people. With regard to Jewish retarded, parenthetically, I prefer some such term as special people, not simply as a euphemism, but because it would more accurately reflect their situation. So this is before, and I'm telling you, you have to read these letters. It will touch you, it will move you.
Did the Rebbe write his letters in Yiddish and have his staff?
He dictated his letters. He would be involved with three letters at a time.
So would he would dictate them?
I don't know if you got what I said. He would be reading a letter, dictating the response of a letter, and what was the third thing? I don't know what the third thing was.
What language would he be using?
Yiddish.
And then it would just be translated by staff to English?
And then he would check it over to make sure it was accurate.
You're using that number specifically three.
Huh?
You're using that number specifically three.
Yeah, something tells me that there were three things going on. The Rebbe received like hundreds, if not thousands, of letters every week. Yeah, so let's read this. So this is particularly true in case of Jewish children with mental illness, yet all too often disregard. There is unfortunately a prevalent misconception that since you are dealing with children of disabilities having more limited capabilities, they should not be burdened with Jewish education on top of their general education so as not to overtax them. In my opinion, this is a fallacious and detrimental attitude, especially in light of what has been said above about the need to avoid impressing the child with his handicap. Be it remembered that a child coming from a Jewish home probably has brothers and sisters or cousins and friends who received a Jewish education or are exposed to Jewish observances. Even in the American society where observant Jews are not yet in the majority, there's always some measure of Jewish experience or Jewish angle in the child's background. Now, therefore, if the child sees or feels that he has been singled out and removed from that experience, or when he will eventually find out that he is Jewish, yet deprived of his Jewish identity and heritage, it is very likely to cause irreparable damage to him. On the other hand, if the child is involved in Jewish education activities and not in some general and peripheral way, but in a regular and tangible way, such as in the actual performance of mitzvot, customs, and traditions, it would give him a sense of belonging and attachment, and a firm anchorage to hold on to, whether consciously or subconsciously. Eventually, even a subconscious feeling of inner security would pass into the conscious state, especially if the teacher will endeavor to cultivate and fortify this feeling. So the Rebbe was very strong about bringing every child, even a child that's dealing with severe mental illness, into the community, into a Jewish community, into observant, into experiences of Jewish observance and mitzvah performance. The Rebbe continues in the letter, in a different letter, but it's still in that series of letters that he writes in his letter. I recently launched a campaign before the holiday of Sukkot that people should go into old age homes and other forms of assisted living homes and spread the holiday cheer of Sukkot and bring a lulav and esrog and do the mitzvah in the homes. And he writes over there in the letter. I'm just going to lift the quote quickly. The reports were profoundly gratifying. Doctors and nurses were astonished to see such a transformation. Persons who had spent countless days in silent immobility, deeply depressed and oblivious to everything around them, the moment they saw a young man walk in with a lulav and esrog in his hand, suddenly displayed a lively interest. Eagerly grasp the proffered mitzvah objects, some of them reciting the blessings from memory without prompting. The joy in their hearts shone through their faces, which had not known a smile all too long. One need not look for a mystical explanation of this reaction. Understandably, the sight of something so tangible and clearly associated with the joy of Sukkot evidently touched and unlocked vivid recollections of experiences that had permeated them in earlier years. And he said it was both true for the elderly and for those of mental illness. Bottom line is, the idea of inclusion is a powerful way. I mean, the whole class today is all about preserving the dignity of those suffering with mental illness. We talk about how one who is safeguarding their interests has to safeguard their interests. Part of that means to include them within the Jewish community. I just wanted to give a quick mention to an institution that was started with the inspiration of the Lubavitcher Rebbe called the Friendship Circle. It started in Detroit in 1994, and it's worldwide today. There's a chapter in Atlanta as well. What this does is it pairs teenage volunteers with children of mental, special needs children, whatever special needs, not only mental, but also physical special needs children as well. And they do tremendous, tremendous work with these kids. And it's just an amazing program. So if you know any teens, or if you want to disguise yourself as a teen and join up and participate, it's unbelievable. You can check it out, friendshipcircle.com. They do amazing, amazing work. All right, so just to wrap up the lesson, we looked at mental illness from a Jewish perspective. We saw that halacha considers mental illness no different than any physical ailment, which must be treated to whatever extent possible. We discovered the extent that Jewish law goes to protect the well-being of those who cannot make their own decisions. We also saw the value in Jewish inclusion, no matter what the perceived ability might be. And Judaism, of course, to conclude, teaches us to love and care for everybody, for everyone, for ultimately we are all one. Next week is our final lesson. It's called Secret Code. Lesson number 6, Secret Code. Genetics and the ethics of patient confidentiality. So today, genetic testing provides doctors with secret information that before would not be known to anybody. Genetic information. The question is, how may this information be handled? What are the privacy issues involved? Can information be disclosed to a prospective spouse, to a loved one, etc., etc., etc.? Come next week, you'll find out, and we'll conclude the series together. I actually have a video that I'm going to show, a trailer for next week, a preview, which you can hang around to check out.